also don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 345. And guess what? It's UCB Live. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, an esteemed and wonderful critic who loves a trip to Spain. It's Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Yes. To all these
I feel
things?
Like if we say that enough, we can get you to the Venice Festival for free.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to manifest and see how it all goes.
Don't tell them where Venice is.
I know. I messed that up, but
Europe, France, it's all fine. It's good. So what's good for me this week, the American Genre Film Archive. This is a very cool little label, actually based out of Austin, and they do really extraordinary restorations of some of the grimier corners of genre film. You know, you're looking for a new 4K of a very boob-tacular Andy Sedaris movie. These are your folks. But they also do a lot of really great preservation of important indie stuff. There's a brand new restoration of Dave Markey's Desperate Teenage Love Dolls, which is a seminal sort of early queer / punk film. They did the release of the films of the late Sarah Jacobson, and did a nice Blu-ray for those. The work of the 60s queer film collective in LA, the Gay Girls Writing Club. So they've made this stuff available. They've got physical media out. You can watch those Gay Girls Writing Club shorts on Tubi. But they are celebrating their 15th anniversary next week here in Los Angeles at USC, and they're doing a couple weeks of screenings that are free to the public, including that new restoration of Desperate Teenage Love Dolls, collections of trailers, Joe Dante's legendary The Movie Orgy from 1968, all kinds of wild stuff. So we'll have the link in the show notes, but it's just something that's really exciting and cool. And even if you aren't in LA and can't go to this program, AGFA is making their work available through streaming, through physical media, and folks should check it out.
You had me at movie, you had Iffy at orgy.
Yeah,
truly. I know my audience here.
Well, let's introduce another part of that audience, which is none other than Super Festival programmer, producer, and queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark. What is good?
I'm glad you remembered my honorific, because I'm here with an official Midwest report. And the fact that it's my second sports related thing in just a handful of months,
wow,
is really something that's going to keep my dad having me in the will. So someone please pass this on to him. Basically, if anybody watched, and many of you did, the women's NCAA tournament was recently and was very exciting for those people who like watching the basketball. But what I am bringing attention to is, so every series they put together the all tournament team, which are like the five best players, and there's all these different rationale. And this year, four of those five, two of them are from Minnesota originally, ooh, Paige Beckers and Tessa Johnson. Two are from Iowa, our Midwestern compatriots, Caitlin Clark and Hannah Stolke. And then also Camila Silva from Brazil. Because if you can't be from the Midwest, you might as well be from Brazil. Anyway, just very delighted with my sister.
They had to go to a whole other hemisphere. And by the way, the women's finals at the NCAA this year, how do I know this? I don't know. Actually got more TV viewers than the men's for once. So I think, as we've seen in soccer, where the women are doing much better and maybe not getting paid as much, I hope that this is boosting the visibility and remuneration as that is involved in women's basketball.
For sure. And it topples absolute nonsense rhetoric that's been standing for decades that people are not interested in women's athletics, which, I have a cursory interest in all athletics. But to say that it's women would be less interesting to me, no, I'm disinterested in most of it across the board. But I love the turning of tides. I'm excited for these ladies. And
I did March Madness brackets for both men's and women's and sucked at both. But I would say equally, though. Good. So, you know, I was very, you know, very ecumenical for that. Iffy, what's good?
Oh, man, what's good with me is, well, look, y'all know I'm a nerd who likes getting into new nerdy things finding new things to just swallow my good money. I'm into fountain pens now.
What are you? And, oh my god!
And this, I gotta
Alonzo
say,
this the is, car over.
This is reading glasses. Mallory O'Meara and one Jeremy Lambert has brought many a new hobby into my life. Jeremy with Warhammer and hockey and Mallory deep with the fountain pen. Oh, and yeah, this is my newest. This one's a sailor, a Japanese fountain pen with a 24 karat gold nib. And they have, you know, seven sizes as opposed to much other ones. And this one is their seventh largest size, which feels like calligraphy, according to the person at Shorthand who sold me this, which I was like, you sure?
If he's going to walk into the Mont Blanc store at the fancy mall and they're going to just smell him coming. And yeah, like, he's going to walk out of there with like a roll top desk and like little bottles of every color ink imaginable.
Or he's going to walk in and they're going to be racist and snooty. And then he's going to get to go back later with his bags full of Bix and do a, you a made a big woman mistake. Huge.
You made a big, yeah. You did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I just call them out on social media and get a bunch of Fremont blocks. So, that does sound, you know, more either you way. That does, yeah, sound more, yeah. That's good. But yeah, no, it's been fun. It's really helped me actually as a writer, because I tried to do the transition to digital, but not to sound all, you know, woo woo going back to the roots. But I find that like note taking on paper with pen makes it stick into my head more and recall it easier. So, I've just had just a nice like leather bound Rhodia that can just go into my back pocket, and I'll whip out this pin, and I feel like it does make me look twee as shit as this giant man, you know. It's like, hold on one second, and I rip it out and I like write with my fountain pen.
If you aren't with the proper quill by 2025, what are we even doing?
Signet ring and wax.
Yeah.
Let me. That's how you'll know that that's Max Film official. Oh man! Well, look, we're gonna have so much fun and so many more laughs on today's episode, because we'll be weighing in on the People's Joker. Then we'll pitch our own fair use, totally legal movie ideas. But first, it's time for Itadic, our movie news segment, where we read through the week's movie news and decide if it's important and if we care. Drea, you're up.
All right. Just when you thought we were done talking about our buddy Dave Lynch for a while, he is back in the news. In an interview with Deadline, Lynch says he's looking for backers for an animated fairy tale project called Snoot World that he's had in the works for decades. The story, like everything he says, most of it I'm like, is he pranking us? But no, the storyline, which Lynch calls old-fashioned and his co-writer Carolyn Thompson calls whackadoo, was apparently too rich for Netflix's blood. Lynch says he pitched Netflix within the past few months and they passed on the film. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, ooh, if Netflix says no, who's got the deeper pockets? I mean, do you now go to Apple? How does that work?
Just right. That is the only other place in town. I do think the best thing about this kind of itadic is, for obvious reasons, nobody knows how anybody's industry works unless they're also in that industry. And even then, half of them seem to be clueless as hell. But this is a great example. You know, whenever you see during Oscar season or something and someone's like, I spent 17 years trying to get this project. And by that point, it's so, you know, prevalent in culture and has been glorified and all these things. And you're like, who wouldn't make this? So the idea of like, oh, people are turning David Lynch down with original ideas. Yes, people getting turned down every day in this town at every level, at every corner. So I hear this and I'm like, oh, David Lynch fairy tale called Snoot World? Yeah, I mean, I would probably be an uphill push with that myself if I had the old green light capabilities. But also, I would like to watch that.
Heck yeah. Well, in a related note, John Waters gave an interview to Variety this week where he said that even though his next film, like, he's got Aubrey Plaza lined up and it's going to be based on his novel, he's still having a hard time getting that money together. And unfortunately, I think you have a lot of these spreadsheet folks, controlling the purse strings. They look at, like, whatever, you know, I guess Inland Empire didn't exactly burn down the box office and neither did A Dirty Shame. And so it's like, sorry, who are you again? Next, you know. So yeah, this is where we are.
And if they want to do it, they're like, great, we'll make a John Waters film. Can you make it for the same budget you made your biggest hit for in 1983?
Non-adjusted.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I do like that this whole story led me to realize that Carolyn Thompson, who's credited here as the co-writer and who wrote Nightmare Before Christmas and Edward Scissorhands and the Addams Family, also wrote Welcome to Marwen, which we have discussed before as one of the most failed adaptation to fiction features.
Documentary, yeah.
Or yeah, sorry, yeah, like a documentary to a fictional retelling ever. She's good stuff. It can fall apart at any level. Filmmaking's risky, y'all. Filmmaking is risky.
Well, speaking of risky and speaking of elder auteurs not getting their respect in the film industry at large, Francis Ford Coppola has reportedly spent $120 million of his own money, because who would do that if not FFC, to realize his vision for Megalopolis, a project he's been cooking up since 1983. At long last, the movie is complete, and in a bid to get into theaters, he recently held a screening at Universal City Walk. Execs from the biggest studios in town were in attendance. The Hollywood Reporter spoke to some of those execs afterwards, and the reports were not real encouraging for the project. Comments suggested the film might be a better fit for a smaller, more independent studio, but that is not what Coppola, again, $120 million in the hole on this thing, has in mind. And breaking news, further twisting the plot, just now as we're recording this, news broke today that Megalopolis will premiere in May in competition at the Cannes Film Festival. Is this important? Do you care?
This is funny to me because Terry, the insane fest director at Cannes, has been trying to get this one for a while. He's good friends with old Frankie Foco. And obviously Cannes has a lot of titles that they are seemingly don't care if it's going to have either a mass walkout or an 18-minute standing ovation. They're going to get the press on that either way, and this is absolutely spectacle terrain. This whole thing is insane. He sold part of his wine empire to pay for this thing. The idea of being able to scrounge, you know, they always say, like, never pay for your own work.
No, the idea of
paying for your own work to the tune of $120 million is so incomprehensible. And part of me applauds the audacity of that. And part of me is like, you know how many independent feature films, creative, inventive, insane, amazing, legacy-building independent films I could have helped build for that, for half of that amount? Like, come on. So it's a real tie. It's also a film he really wants to show in IMAX. Like, there's not money in the world. And he, you know, to put you the marketing and the P&A, the print and advertising spend you have to do on something like this, it's like another $100 million. My guess is he's going to have to ante up even more to get that happen if he wants a theatrical. The way I read it, again, I see Apple's the only play in town that has the money for this kind of thing. And like they did Killers of the Flower Moon, which was another like real risky. This is a million times riskier. And the feedback from that screening, it did become a very who's who. If you made the cut for Frankie's morning screening where he rented out the IMAX at Universal Theater and like literally like studio heads were there and other directors. I mean, that was the place to be. See and be seen.
Clearly. I'm sure the schmoozing was great, even if they were lukewarm on the movie. Yeah, I'm dying to see this thing because even I just saw the new edit of One from the Heart that's coming out on Blu-ray in a couple of months. And even a Francis Ford Coppola failure is more interesting than most people's best movie.
Ooh.
Okay, more interesting than a lot of people's best movie.
I think I would have said that earlier, but like his past few films, I'm like, oh man, that's
granted, I didn't see Twixt.
Right? Like that's how art works. Like, Did you see, like, what are the last directing things he had? I just remember them being all kind of painful. Like, he had, you know, what's the last thing he, like, Distant Vision, Twixt, Tetro, Youth Without Youth.
I've been sleeping on these for a while, so yeah, you're right.
And that goes back to 2007. Like, nobody's watching these, and anyway, they were a lot.
No, this is where the spreadsheet folks come in. They're looking like, oh, your last hit was The Rainmaker? Okay. You know, and that's a good 30-ish years ago.
Shout out to my friend Hannah Hinkle, assistant prop master on Megalopolis. Lived in Atlanta this whole time. She has seen some things.
All right. Well, speaking of seeing some things, Disney is setting its sights on 2026 and has announced a ton of planned theatrical releases for that year, including Star Wars spinoff The Mandalorian and Grogu, a live-action remake of Moana, and Toy Story 5. The live-action Moana was originally set for 2025. This later date will create more space between its release and the animated Moana 2. Slated for later this year. It's not all remakes and sequels, though. Night Bitch, starring Amy Adams, is set for November, while The Amateur, a spy thriller starring Rami Malek, will come out this time next year. Is this important? Do you care?
How do we broadcast the face I just made at the list of, like, just the Moana notes?
Yeah.
Why are you doing a lot? What? Come on, quit making me feel old. Like, give me some of that money. Something else.
Well, you know, it's so funny because I think a lot about things like early Disney, when, like, if it was a sequel, it was like straight to DVD, and they were always trying to do new stories. Like,
you mean early iffy Disney?
Yeah. I wasn't talking. You know, I was talking about.
We're not talking
you know,
about Steamboat Willie here.
Yeah, I'm talking about VHS.
That's early Alonzo Disney.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
You know, VHS Disney.
Right.
But yeah.
I love Toy Story 3. Do we need a Toy Story 5? I don't know.
I mean, everyone was so, like, pleased and, like, satisfied when they thought Toy Story 3 was going to be the last one. And then.
Yeah. But even those, fine. That universe is interesting to me. Does it need to be? No. Then it really turns into extended form television. And we've had that conversation with many franchises. My thing is, if you have that money, like, I don't understand the live action remakes. I mean, I do because I am a bit of a spreadsheet dork myself, but the live action remakes that they've been doing just seem so mercenary. Like, there's no soul to them. And if you're going to put that much money into it, you're Disney. Like, there's other IP from 1,000 years ago, from Alonzo's youth, you could be using. Like, to just be
from the Nickelodeons.
And to be regurgitating, like, nobody needs that. We just saw Moana. Like, we just watched two. You're either taking us through the animation or, you know what I mean? There's nothing exciting about doing it live action to me. Like, be innovative in new ways or reinvent something. Like, I was excited when they did Enchanted and then even Disenchanted. Like, that was taking, oh, it's the Disney formula. You're tweaking it because it's sort of a hybrid of live action and animated. You're giving us a real life princess in our world. Like, there's a subversion of things there. You're trying to build, and I don't know. It's exhausting to me.
But see, Dre, if they do the animated remakes, eventually we will get that Home on the Range with CG cows that I'm really dying for.
Listen, don't let me poke your dreams.
It'll be sometime after they get around to doing Fantastic Planet and the Black Cauldron, you know?
Oh, yeah. Black Cauldron! Yeah.
CinemaCon is coming up, and that's what all this, like, jockeying of release dates is. And I just read a whole thing about Lionsgate moving a bunch of stuff around. And the only thing of that leapt out of me is that the best Christmas pageant ever has moved from November 15th to November 8th, giving it an extra week for the holidays. But yeah, this stuff, it's like, yeah, it's going to show up, and I will go see it dutifully. And then in 6 months, I'll be like, which was that one again?
Fun fact, I leave for CinemaCon tomorrow.
Ah.
Yes, get that. Enjoy CinemaCon where you're there.
Bring your spreadsheets.
Yes, and speaking of spreadsheets, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to spread the sheet on the People's Joker.
Are you tired of being picked on for only wanting to talk about your cat at parties?
Do you feel as though your friends don't understand the depth of love you have for your guinea pig?
When you look around a room of people, do you wonder if they know sloths only have to eat one leaf a month?
Have you ever dumped someone for saying they're just not an animal person?
Us too.
She's Alexis B. Preston.
She's Ella McLeod.
And we host Comfort Creatures, the show where you can't talk about your pets too much, animal trivia is our love language, and dragons are just as real as dinosaurs.
Tune in to Comfort Creatures every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
All right, welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duralde.
We first started talking about today's movie as an itty-dick when its premiere at TIFF was nearly canceled after Warner Brothers Legal sent a director Vera Drew a letter claiming that the film infringed upon its brand. 18 months and a few rolls of red tape later, the film is finally being shown to more audiences across the country. Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of The People's Joker?
Sure. All right. So this is an interesting... parody, real life story put on top of existing characters and worlds. We are following an awkward young woman as she is grappling with her gender identity, growing up in Smallville, and dealing with her mostly single mother and not being understood and not feeling at home in her body or the world, but understanding more and more that she wants to be a comedian. She finds herself moving to Gotham, and as she discovers that the comedy there has mostly been outlawed, she joins the sole authorized comedic program, UCB, which is a funnel of sorts to UCB Live, a very thinly veiled Saturday Night Live stand-in. And after realizing the inherent kind of misogyny and nerdery there, she departs with her new BFF, the Penguin, and starts her own comedy club with every villain you've ever heard of in the DC world, putting on their, you know... Well, not everyone. The ones that I've heard of. Definitely Ify and Alonzo have heard of more. She starts this anti-comedy troupe and just falls in love and fully lives as a woman that she is, all while dealing with the stupid caped crusader above. The People's Joker? I don't know how I did that, but there you go.
Yeah, as anyone
could.
All right, you know, I'm going to kick this off with one of, you know, Marissa's prompts, which, you know, I felt, so I was like, yeah, this is a good kickoff. This is a very DIY film, where it's low-budget visuals, a hurdle to getting into the movie. I asked Spirit Award nominee, Queen of Indies, Drea Clark.
I was like, yeah, it sounded almost like a question and almost.
Oh yeah. No, it was like a question, everyone. Yeah. But then I was just teasing you because like, I'm like, yeah, you live for the DIY.
No, you're so right. I do live for the DIYs. This is a very slam dance film. This is a very next section of Sundance film. Like there's all sorts of festival imprints on here, partly because so much of what Festival Discovery is looking for is exactly this. It's the sense of real dynamic, authorial voice and a very personal POV to the storytelling. The DIY elements of it, when I tell you, I mean, I watch things with like $17 budgets all the time. So I'm very used to, I know Alonzo is subjected to a lot more of those than your average human as well. And so that's easier for me to get into. This one, at least the best part about its visuals, because it does all of these very sort of like rotoscoped compositing, terrible green screen, but it's super consistent. Like it's varying at times. Like you get to the comedy club and some of them are hand-drawn. Some of them are these weird sort of 3D rendered animatronic. Like there's just all sorts of things. But the crudeness of them and how they're utilized and how the world building works is so consistent that you feel you're not distanced from it. It's accessible because you feel safe in Vera Drew's hands as a filmmaker of, oh, she's doing this to artfully get across this world and this story, not, oh, I'm filling in the gaps because this location fell through and whatever. And so that part of it, they weren't a hurdle to me in that way.
No, agreed. I think that they turned the budget and the style of the film into a feature and not a bug. And I think about films like Ang Lee's Hulk or that terrible gender reassignment movie that Walter Hill did, The Assignment with Michelle Rodriguez, where they do like kind of frame within frame and they try and ape the look of what a comic book is. Mm. And this movie is almost sort of a zine, you know, it feels like someone who's interested in comics but is doing it very DIY. And so this page is just Xerox stuff and this page is blobby, you know, ink things or whatever. But
collages.
You're right. Exactly. But it does all feel like it comes from the same place. It does feel like a consistency of vision, even though apparently a lot of these different things were farmed out to various folks during the pandemic to create. So, yeah, I think it absolutely makes the most of this and turns what could have been a hurdle if they tried to sort of work around it or cover it up or whatever. They put it front and center in it, and it becomes essential to what this story is and how it's being told.
And just to jump into that, I think the framework of this is unique. And obviously, like, the press that it garnered, the fact that she ended up playing a good number of festivals and all of them had to be like secret screenings. It's been all this stuff of her dealing with navigating what fair use means and copyright infringement and all of that, which is you already have enough you're going up against as an indie filmmaker. But that said, the root of what's really, really interesting about this is how well she's dovetailed this world of these characters with her own journey. Like with also there's a meta element because she talks about, you know, she's young and she watches a film that she does not identify as Batman, but and has an animated Nicole Kidman and was like, I was watching it and I looked and was like, oh, I want to be Nicole Kidman. Like, it was that kind of an awakening moment. And you get the sense, I love it with filmmakers who are making personal work that I'm like, oh, that is legitimately the crux of things. Like, that was a moment of awakening. And to not just make that a throwaway in like something that was then just set in suburbia and moving along, but to use it as a catalyst to where all of the rest of this is being explored. Like, oh, therefore, I'm going to set this in Gotham. Therefore, I'm going to become Joker the Harlequin and combine these elements of existing characters. Like, that's the artistic leap that to me is so much more indicative of a true kind of creative genius than just, oh, this was my story and I wanted to be Nicole Kidman, you know?
There's a great magazine cartoon where like a kid goes to see Batman and Robin. He's very excited about it. And in the course of the strip, he's like looking at the screen. And first he's got like an enthusiastic face and then kind of a slightly confused face and then a somewhat concerned face. And he walks out of the theater, still got the concerned face. And he goes, well, I'm definitely not straight. Yes. And I think so the idea that Batman Forever was that movie for Vera Drew, you know, like is you know, the Joel Schumacher of it all, I think really lands. You know, Vera Drew in an article, in an interview with the New York Times that that Marissa sent us, kind of goofs on the thing that Stan Lee used to always say about Marvel Comics, about how these are the myths of our era. We are creating the modern myths. And when you think about all the films that you've seen that are borrowing from Hamlet or Oedipus Rex or, you know, the myth of Sisyphus, whatever, like these sort of these just ingrained narratives that we then sort of add whatever period to and whatever personal experience to, so that Vera Drew has basically done that with the Batman cinematic universe and the comics and touching upon everything from the Schumacher movies to the Frank Miller, you know, Dark Knight to the TV show to whatever else. But use that as the vehicle for like, this is my coming out story as a trans person. This is my arc as someone coming to understand who they are and what their art is going to be, and like the red flag of, you know, never date a comedian. I want to ask Giphy about that. You know, I thought was a brilliant melange of the two things.
Yeah, no. This film is so fun for so many reasons. I think that right now, currently in the nerd space, mostly in the video game front, but all over, because I wonder if I mentioned this last week, or maybe I was yelling about this on another podcast, but the Republican pearl clutching over DEI and pretending as if it gave some upper leg has like bled into the games industry, in the way that, you know, there's like a second Gamergate where people are, you know, saying that all these like consulting firms that are making sure that people are covering like people of color and women correctly are ruining games. And it's just a weird place to be a nerd. One of the like Warhammer painters who I really love, this French dude who like paints, the Space Marines in like the colors of the gay flag. And everyone's like making that like nerddom at its height. And I think just the fanning of the flames of like, you know, knee-jerk racism for a lot of these online grifters and a lot of these, you know, criminals who are running for president who need that base to be like charged up. It's all kind of just bubbled up in a terrible way in the nerd space. And I think this film is such a perfect just fuck you to all of it, in the sense that not only is it just this great trans coming out story, but also it's like on its shit with all of its like nerd info. Like it is just a just flat out perfect nerd parody film. Like it's just like there's so many great homages, there's so many just like lore drops throughout it. It's done so well. It to me, it is just another version of what people felt the Joaquin Phoenix Joker was, and done like artfully so.
So it's much like, more.
This is its own Joker story in its own Batman world, and I believe it. I want it. I'd love to see it.
I love you mentioning the Joker because Mr. J is here. He's very much styled after the Jared Leto version. And which again could be a very comic version. I'm not sure. Sorry, don't come at me. But one of the things I really applaud Vera Drew as a filmmaker is the Joker is also trans. It's one of the first things that we find out about him.
Yeah.
And so it's not only an introduction to a unique trans journey for this woman, but it's introducing people to a T for T relationship with not a lot of them, maybe in the, you know, broader sense, are familiar with. And the complexity of making, to me, this incredibly sympathetic character in Joker the Harlequin, who you watch as a young kid just not understood or supported by their mother, and like that's the other origin of it, is the mother takes them to the psychiatrist, they get put on Smilex to cheer up, and their whole thing is like, I'm so sorry, I won't make you sad anymore, and like that's where the forced smile of the Joker comes from, and like that is heartbreaking. You get all of that, but then you also get the complexities of Mr. J, who is on their own trans journey, has gone through their own traumatic relationship, and yet she is very clear in pointing out he is a bad boyfriend. This is an abusive relationship.
Trans toxic masculinity.
Right? Trans toxic masculinity. And the presenting the complexities of that and looking at any audience and being like, you can handle this. I am giving you very easily ingestible information in a very fun, rollicking story. And you can handle all of these concepts that may be brand new to some of you. And I appreciate that because we talk a lot about like, oh, it's like the singular trans story or the singular like Korean adoptee story. Like you don't want to have to represent everything, but the idea of putting your personal story and also giving other textures of what trans experience is, good and bad, like, and that it's really about like the people living those lives and how they're treating other people. I loved that.
Yeah. Same. Big same.
Oh, I do like this. Marissa just put in, because so much of this set in the comedy world, and there is this I do want to hear, because we do see like Poison Ivy do stand up. You see, like, I want to hear Iffy's thoughts on the stand up of their anti-comedy club.
I mean, like, yeah, their whole the whole bastion, the fake SNL in this world is UCB, and when you get there, it actually is goofing on a lot of like the actual facts of UCB. Led,
are you putting, a man?
Yeah. You're putting there's no like dick contest, but it is like kind of one of the clear cuts. I don't know if it's as the same as the comedy world was shaken up by, you know, the pandemic, but it was like looked at as like the only way to make it into SNL or make it as a comedian is go through this school where you have to spend all this money. And it is still very much, and for a lot of the diversity and the strides that they've tried to make to make a larger space, you know, it's still just like a peer of predominantly cishet folks. So, you know, all the queer stuff that you try and do out there becomes like a cool space for the queer kids. But I think, you know, what's very interesting is like, yeah, what, like, where's the integration? And it was very funny. I think the fact that their big solution to beat the UCB was to create alt comedy was very funny, right? And especially since this is made by alt comedians, and it was very,
and then like Maria Bamford was Lorne Michaels.
Yes. it was so interesting too, because it was like, that's kind of what like really happened in New York, where how alt comedy blew up because the club system was just so hard and would never give space for, you know, the weirdo comics. So they had to make their own space. And now it's like all integrated. So it was very funny because I thought it was truly going to riff on that. But it did in a fun way, but told its own story.
Yeah.
While also reminding us, never date a comedian. Yes.
I also, I'm gonna second that. Many of us spend our younger years in Los Angeles making that tragic mistake.
Unless
that
it's Iffy, because he's, you know, that's a whole other thing.
Oh yeah, everyone is welcome to date Iffy.
Yeah, but outside of that, yeah, I would also give you the same advice. Do not date a comedian.
Yeah, here.
Yeah.
I do, before, I want us to vote, but before then, can we also just pay like a little tribute to one of the best recurring jokes I've seen in a while, which is every single time they were in conversation and then mentioned something terrible that was like the exception to the rule. Someone would say the thing and the other person would go, of course. And then
that was also one of my favorite.
Every time they would reference, like, you know, Cosby or Louis C.K. Yes. or somebody before the, I thought, oh, well,
you know, I really admire like an early Cosby before the days. Of course.
Before, of course.
Yeah. I found the comic timing throughout impeccable.
For sure.
Yeah.
10 out of 10. Would,
are we at a vote? Is it vote time? Did I rush too early for the vote?
No, let's vote. Vote.
Awesome.
The way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory.
I'm a screen it for sure. I think this movie is taking all the big swings and they're landing. The, you know, form meets function. It is a queer movie in all the senses of the term, not just in being a queer story, but in totally knowing what rules to throw out and how, and using that as a way to make the story land better. Kudos to Altered Innocence for taking this film on, even though they do not have a hundredth of the lawyers that Warner Brothers does. If he's totally right about the toxic nerd bros out there, because I just looked on IMDb and this movie has so many one votes, and I'm sure they were all delivered by people who haven't even seen the goddamn thing yet.
Yeah.
No, definitely.
Just the idea of it, which is what's so annoying about a lot of these tours, because I feel like even the chuddiest of chuds would I truly believe they would watch this and enjoy it, because I think it touches on all the nerd stuff they like. I think it tells the story in a very fun way, but they are just so sure they're going to hate it. Because
if you thought Todd Phillips' Joker was transgressive, hold my rubber chicken.
Yes, exactly.
They
don't want to see us win.
For sure. I am definitely a screen it. I was enamored with this. I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I was, you know, I like an inventive movie that's making a broad, but I just enjoyed it on a lot of levels I was not expecting to. I think that Nathan Faustin, who played the Penguin, had a genuinely lovely performance. He's doing a whole lot, like in the worst prosthetic nose you've ever seen in your entire human life. Vera Drew as Joker the Harlequin is this incredibly compelling, that sort of neurotic character it's impossible to not have a crush on, that kind of energy. And yeah, there's a really beautiful vulnerability to all of this, with all of the jokes, with all of the references, with all of this whole world building. The recurring heart of it, the shape of her relationship with her mother, there's a lot of sophistication going on here, and I am tremendously excited to see what she does next. But I really hope a lot of people check this out. I mean, I think it's the kind of, to me, very accessible, but really unique and really distinctive personal filmmaking that makes me love independent movies. So yeah, I screen it, please.
Yes.
What's yours?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to screen it, too. Sorry. I was so wrapped up in it, I thought I already said it. Yeah, no, I'm definitely a screen it. This is great, and I can't wait to see if we can get Maggie to put this up at Vidiots.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, let's just go ahead and take a break, and then when we come back, we'll have some more show. But we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
What is up, people of the world? Do you have an argument that you keep having with your friends and you just can't seem to settle it? And you're sitting there arguing about whether it's Star Trek or Star Wars, or you can't decide what is the best nut, or can't agree on what is the best cheese?
Stop doing that. Listen to We Got This with Mark and Hal, only on Max Fun.
Your topics asked and answered objectively, definitively, for all time.
So don't worry, everybody. We got this.
We got this.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonso Duralde,
Drea Clark.
In the opening frame of today's film, a title card cites the project's legality under Code 17 of U.S. copyright law. Code 17 states that fair use of copyrighted work for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research is not an infringement of copyright. If you were going to make a film that would test the limits of Code 17 in the spirit of Vera Drew, what copyrighted work would you choose, and what would you use it to comment on or report, criticize, etc.?
This very question, no joke, made me appreciate this movie all the more, because I was like, I can think of plenty of things that would be fun to parody, but a lot of the things that I love anyway are already making a comment that I agree or appreciate.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, well, how do you maneuver them? Like, she is maneuvering all of Batman's world to make this like trans journey come to life, right? I was like, I don't even. Anyway, it started to break my brain in thinking of different ways to do this. Like, I would think of something and then I would be like, ooh, and then you could do this, and I would realize I described a film that already exists. Like, oh, so you would make that thing that's already been real. So anyway, think on that. It's why so many people get parody wrong, because most of them don't understand the concept of commentary, let alone if you're trying to do it to bypass copyright infringement. So I did come up with something, but I want to hear Alonso's. I feel like you have a good one right there.
I mean, it's kind of the same thing where in a way it's been done. But I was thinking that you could take the framework of Citizen Kane and apply it to so many terrible billionaires of now who started out with like noble intentions, but ultimately are broken people who really just desperately want to be loved and will go to extremes to get that no matter who they hurt. So, you know, like Citizen Musk, Citizen Bezos, there's like so many ways you could do that. But weirdly enough, so much of the structure of Citizen Kane did get used quite flagrantly by Todd Haynes in the movie Velvet Goldmine. You know, you've got the camera through skylight. You've got, like, there's so many moments that are plucked right out of that film. But, and what made me think of this was, back when I was doing that show, A Film and a Movie, with Daniel Thompson, when we would pair films, and one of the ones we did was Citizen Kane and The Social Network, and how they're both these movies about these media moguls, you know, like trying to, you know, get everything they want in the world and just kind of falling apart in the process. And so I sort of feel like the Kane scenario that Wells and Herman Mankiewicz created could be applied to so many titans of business who are just frightened little boys.
I love this. I want to get some of that Frankie Foco's $120 million and we'll greenlight it. That's great. So please know when I was like halfway to imagining something, I was like, oh, they made that. What I was imagining was something in the James Bond world. And then what I realized is I was going to pitch Austin Powers, essentially. So when I'm like, oh, nope, that's not even it. Also, no commentary, like just parody. So where I ended up, and everyone listening and probably my two compatriots here can help fill in the blanks in their heads or verbally, because I'm not totally there yet. But, you know, this is a safe space. So I thought, okay, Terminator, the world of the Terminators. We have a whole range of this. We have the different T whatevers. And there's the Arnold that's like skeleton-y, metal skeleton-y. And then we have the Robert Patrick. Thank you. Robert Bateman. Robert Patrick. And he's, you know, the metal, whatever. I was like, it's the Terminator world and the whole idea of Skynet. Oh, it's we have to travel back in time to stop Skynet. And I was like, oh, great. Well, it's right there. Then I want to do this as something about the looming worries of AI. But the difference is less that it becomes sentient, which is kind of what Skynet is, right? Like, it's become its own entity. It's free will. It's free thinking. It's running. But more that what AI does, how I see it, is that, oh, it's just actually killing everything that is uniquely and beautifully human and flawed. And the idea of sending a second person, like a Cassandra-style woman that nobody believes, who's supposed to, like, they send the Terminator and then they're like, wait, you know what? Nope. It's not Sky. It's a whole thing. It's that the humans empowered Skynet. We don't even need the resistance. So whatever. It's also because I forgot part of Terminator, but mostly I like the idea of somebody getting to try and kill Arnold in all of those ways that he, like, kills other people in the first one, or then that Robert Patrick does, because, you know, like that extended, like, metal arm thing through the woman's skull. Anyway, it's not fully baked, you guys. I'm not ready to pitch this to whatever studio it would be ripping off, but I think there's something there.
I like the idea of writing a novel so bad that feeding it to AI would just ruin the whole thing. Because all AI does is just consume regurgitate.
Yeah.
So, like, if you could just, like, have something that was so already clunky and the sentences were so malformed that it just took AI's way of making things malformed and just spun it onto itself until it just blew up, you know.
I like that. So maybe it's that it's not even, it's more meta. Maybe it's less someone actually going after the Terminator. It's more the whole story of the Terminator going back in time is what's being fed to this Skynet in the future to blow it up, because it's such a stupid story.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Here, take this in. Okay. All right. I'll keep working on it.
Charlie Kaufman on the line.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mine would just be, using Birth of a Nation to talk about how stupid racism is. And, like, all the scenes with black people, I just walk around wiping their face off and just be like, yeah, no, white people are doing these crimes. You had it right before the makeup. and just continue that way. Like it would just be just me kind of walking through. And anytime someone, like, thought to try and fight against me, I'll pull out a cell phone and mystify them.
I just watched Peter Bogdanovich's Nickelodeon, which I'd never seen, which is a film about his sort of salute to the very early days of silent film. And the movie ends with everyone going to the premiere of Birth of a Nation and being like, oh, I'll never make a movie that good. It was just like, oof. Okay. I mean, yes, I suppose if you were there, you thought that, but ooh, man.
Yeah, buddy. Read the new room. Oh, yeah, I guess yes, we did it. And I guess those will just get made now. So feel free. You can
after Megalopolis gets into IMAX theaters, that's going to be his next thing.
Yeah. So yeah, you just get it in there. But yeah, now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Who wants to star?
I have an old one, so I just want to launch in real quick. So one of my favorite American directors, Stanley Donen, who with Gene Kelly co-created, you know, Singin' in the Rain, arguably one of the greatest American movies ever made, but also On the Town and It's Always Fair Weather. And then on his own, you know, was responsible for such masterpieces as Charade and Funny Face. He hits his centenary this Saturday. The day after this episode drops would have been his 100th birthday in a world where he was still around. And so I was just thinking about him this week and wanting to recommend some of his stuff. And of course, the movie that I'm always, always pushing on people. And one of these days when I get my way, on this program, we're going to talk about Stanley Donen's Two for the Road, starring Albert Finney and Audrey Hepburn. For my money, one of the great movies about marriage, one of the great, like, romantic dark comedies, one of the great sort of character studies of what happens to young love as it turns into domesticity. It's available for rent online, and if you've never seen it, you're in for a treat.
It's so good. And it's been a while since you mentioned it, because I used to get to make fun of that all the time.
It's true. I know. It was a bit.
I've really missed that. I miss us. Yeah. Well, my movie is new. So in your face, Alonzo.
Don't tell me. Did it premiere at Sundance?
Girl, you know it.
Boom.
Actually, I think it did. Yeah, it definitely did. That movie, I'm so, whatever. But it was really, you know, I'm not always good at tying things back to the film we were talking about. But in looking at, like, all right, what is some outrageous, very personally driven, queer, indie, meta, odd, doing its own thing? And of course, what came to mind, Sebastian Silva's Rotting in the Sun, which came out last year. It was a Sundance film. Some people may know Sebastian Silva from his other films like Crystal Fairy and The Magical Cactus, Nasty Baby, The Maid. But he's a Chilean filmmaker. He also stars in this as himself. He's relaxing at a gay beach town in Mexico where you're going to see so many dongs. You have never expected to see this many dongs on film in something you didn't pay for in an interesting way. And then he meets an Instagram influencer named Jordan Firstman, who's played, of course, by Jordan Firstman. And it turns into an absolute insanity. They're going to collaborate, and then Sebastian goes missing, and then Jordan is like on this kind of detective maneuvering. It's insane and so weird, and again, so many dongs. But I loved it. I love its uniqueness. It's really strange and brave, and also Catalina Saavedra was nominated for a Spirit Award for this. So yes, Rotting in the Sun, and it's currently on an Alonzo Network on Mubi. But you can rent it on Vudu and Apple as well. If you want to check it out.
Ooh. All right. And mine, you know, I went and I tapped into all the different tendrils that have helped make this movie great. One friend of the pod, technically Scott Aukerman, is in this film, who helped make the Between Two Ferns the movie. So yeah, that's my pick, doing that connection, using that connective tissue for another film filled with a bunch of comedy dorks who make me chuckle. So you know,
I watched Scott Aukerman sing Clay Aiken's Invisible at karaoke, and it remains one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life to this day.
Yeah. That sounds about right. Nothing you said sounds out of character.
And Between Two Ferns is on Netflix.
Yes. So hurry up before they take it off for some dumbass reason. All right. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. And we need some new hotline calls. So go to MaximumFun.org/hotline and leave us a voicemail. Because you know what happens when there's no voicemails? I have to tell you that we have a dry ass voicemail and we want a wet ass voicemail.
As soon as possible. When he got there. Yeah.
I've told you before and I told you again, anytime we don't have voicemail, I'm going to have to mention how we need some wet ass voicemails. If you don't ever want to hear me say that, you know how to fix it.
Please, we beg you. And if you send emails, Iffy will come up with a completely inappropriate accent for your voice.
Yeah, I got a VO audition for a Haitian accent. I'm like, am I going to go for it? We'll see. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about Sasquatch Sunset. Our wonderful producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is also wonderful. Her name is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.